for transference on the techniques, at least some techniques for synthesis. And when I have in mind synthesis, I mean synthesis at various levels, though what I have indicated here is operative on broader levels, including book as a whole levels of material. One way of synthesizing, bringing together your interpretations, would have to do with answering survey questions, structural questions in survey. For example, had we taken the structural questions we asked on 2 Timothy in regard to, say, the recurring pattern of exhortation and causation, substantiation, and asked what's the meaning of each exhortation, what's the meaning of each cause and effect, and how do the cause and effect support the exhortations, etc. If you were to take that kind of question, obviously, and try to answer it in the process of analysis, and then come to some kind of synthesis on the basis of that question, you'd have the book as a whole, wouldn't you? So, with regard to these structural questions and looking at the book as a whole, you begin answering them in analysis. You complete the answers insofar as you answer them in synthesis. One good way of asking whether you really synthesized the book as a whole is to ask yourself, have I answered the questions I asked in the survey? A second element is to summarize the needs to which the book is addressed and how these needs are met by the book. Every book is addressed to certain needs, so that can be done really by in any book. You have a certain kind of historical background against which the book is written, enough that ought to be kept in mind by way of dealing with these the needs are addressed. Then a third way is to state the theme of a book in a proposition form, that could be even less than a sentence form, maybe a full sentence, or in essay form, a paragraph or two. Or one could trace what is said about one or more of the main motifs of a book. This is the sort of topical approach. Now, in so doing, I would be analytical. In other words, if you were to say, take the motif of what's involved in being a Christian minister, from Christian ministry. 2 Timothy. One ought not merely to list all the statements related to Christian ministry, but one ought to analyze them as to what aspect of Christian ministry they involve, and bring together similar ideas. Now, if you're dealing with biographical materials, of course, you could do a biographical kind of synthesis, or you could do a doctrinal kind of synthesis, or a historical kind of synthesis. If you're dealing with some key terms, you would want to define those terms in the process. Another way, and this it works particularly in shorter areas such as segments, you can make a list of the main truths or emphases of that segment. Bring together the chief motifs. Then one could use some visual means such as a diagram or chart. One could outline material. Some of you worked with me in Romans, the metallogical outline in Romans 1:18 to 8:39. That's an excellent way of synthesizing thought. Or it could be a topical outline depending on the nature of the material, which type of outline best lends itself to the nature of the material. Or a paraphrase, especially for short passages, a good way of bringing together a number of findings. So what you do in interpretation is to select questions, answer individual questions by trying to identify relevant evidence, using that evidence by way of drawing inferences from the evidence. On that basis, trying to answer the question, whatever that may take. But then you have a series of questions to which you have answers, and you have to bring these answers together to synthesize. So this really involves a synthesis of answers to a series of questions. including case number one, entering structural questions. I thought I ought at least to present this to you so that you're aware of this aspect of things. How much time you want to take in terms of discussing it, I don't know. I ought to ask you whether you have any questions about what we mean by these things and how they might be applied. Some of you have done this already. Some of course have taken Pauline epistles, general epistles, Egyptians, and Hebrews, of course, the theological and the Romans. Some of you have been keen for this. Any questions on what we've said here?
You can do logical outlines for books that are not primarily logical. And I guess you can also, for instance, I was thinking of what would you have to
do? As I conceive a logical outline, it lends itself to argumentative materials. Hebrews, for example, the argumentative portion of the Hebrews, the men themselves, to this kind of thing. So that you'd be dealing primarily with discursive literary form, and particularly argumentative form. You try to capture the argument, flow of the argument, a certain portion of it. But I use this as a key device in the Romans. I've done it for Hebrews. It could be done for certain portions of other epistles. It doesn't lend itself very well to the synthesis of oratory materials. They're very often more of a topical kind of thing. That's if you want to use an outline. Any questions, comments on this?
I understand these to be ways of synthesizing.
Right.
And, for instance, you don't have any favorites. You just adapt the best one for the literature you're working
with. Right. For example, Ephesians is primarily Christological and physiological, primarily about Christ and the church, so those could be key topics that you use for some synthesizing Ephesians. So you really, in most cases, you adapt the technique to the kind of material you're synthesizing. Although some of these, of course, are applicable to all kinds of materials, or all kinds of forms. For example, number one would be applicable everywhere.
Samuel Kings and the Chronicles,
yes, particularly for the four books of the King, First and Second Samuel, First and Second. Okay. All right, let's move to a matter of evaluation application. Bernardo Clairvaux, I think, said it beautifully, the Bible is a book to be lived. In fact, the bottom line with regard to Bible study has to do with how the study of the Scriptures affect life. If one accepts their authority, and we'll be talking about that in just a moment. There is, however, a prior question with regard to this whole area, and that question is whether or not one does accept the biblical authority. And this has to do with what I would call the general evaluation of Scripture. It's over against the specific evaluation of individual texts prior to their application, which of course assumes that one accepts biblical authority. Now there are two main issues with regard to general evaluation. Is it possible to evaluate or to validate the Scriptures to determine whether they should be authoritative for faith and practice?
Craig, can you focus any better?
In other words, the possibility of evaluation in its general sense. And the answer receives both negative and positive responses, the question does. There are those who say there is no possibility of evaluating or validating Scripture. One of the classic proponents of that point of view is Karl Barth, And Karl Barth argues on two bases. One is that what he calls Heilsgeschichte, sacred history, holy history, belongs to a different category of history from world or profane history, secular history. And so you cannot apply the canons that you apply to secular history to this different kind of history. It's a sort of transcendent history. It's a history that's above world history and not a part of the continuum of world history. Now, he came to this conclusion because he was dealing with a certain kind of historical criticism, which was positivistic, which operated on certain a priori's. For example, one cannot believe something as historical that does not have analogies in history. In other words, on the basis of the usual canons of historical criticism, it's impossible to believe in a unique event in history. You know, someone wrote a history book and said, I once saw a donkey flying, and I think most of us would have some grave doubts about the facticity of that. Why? Because we don't see donkeys flying, say. And the usual historical criticism operates on the basis of analogy. You believe those things that reoccur. And of course, biblical history has it in it unique events. So, Barth said, you cannot apply historical criticism, traditionally understood, and in fact, to his mind, properly understood, to biblical history. Ergo, it must be some other kind of history. Ergo, you must take it by faith. Either take it by faith or don't take it. There's no way of validating it. Either you believe it or you don't. And if one were to press those who hold to this point of view, they would say that faith is based on the inner testimony of a spirit. Your spirit, that this is true, even though there's no way of validating. By the way, there's a third argument used, namely that any attempt to validate it could not possibly achieve certitude. And you must have certitude for authority, for faith and practice. Now, there are other expressions of this point of view, but that's one expression of a negative point of view. There are those who give a positive answer to this, and I happen to be one of those, correct me wrongly. So we have the second issue. If possible and necessary, if there is a possibility of validation, how does one engage in such evaluation or validation? This will have to do with the nature of or the basis for evaluation, in a general sense. And various answers are given to that question on the basis of those who try to validate scriptures. There are those who use philosophical reason, such as is true of C.F.H. Henry, Carl Henry. And that's true of many who have written books on apologetics. And there are other approaches that have been used. My own approach involves what I would call historical reason, something of the kind of thing that Richard Niebuhr does in his book, The Resurrection and Historical Reason. Not that I go along with everything that Richard Niebuhr says, but at least he seems to be attacking the problem along the lines in which I would attack it. Now, what is this historical mode of evaluation? Obviously, it would not be the kind of positivistic historical criticism that Barth felt was unusable, because I feel that's unusable too. But the reason why I would not limit myself to that kind of thing is because I think there are serious deficiencies in that sort of historical criticism. Now, the moment you say something cannot happen in history, it seems to me you're foreclosing certain historical possibilities, including the possibility of a unique in history. What you're doing is you're reducing history to the realm of nature, say, to the realm of the non-human world, and to what we call the laws of science. You know, in science, the only way to validate something is to reproduce it in the laboratory. Why? Because if it happens in one aspect of existence, it ought to be able to happen elsewhere. If you can't reproduce it, then it's unprovable. So. But as Wilhelm Dilthey emphasized, and Wilhelm Dilthey was a late 19th century philosopher of history, historical materials are different from scientific materials, and a different methodology needs to be used. And one needs to leave room for the unique. One cannot begin by saying, this cannot happen in history. One asks, what has this happened? Now, what are the arguments pro and con with regard to whether or not this event, even though it may be unique, has happened? Now, with that assumption, the thesis would be that since the scriptures are essentially historical, and historical mode of evaluation and validation can and should be used to determine whether they deserve to be authoritative for faith and practice. Now, as I say, not the kind that Karl Barth rejected for the simple reason that that kind obviates a priori the possibility of biblical history, including acts of God, okay, unique acts of God. But an historical mode which looks at scriptures primarily as events which can be validated in some way is the kind of thing I have in mind. Now, one has to recognize the goal of this kind of enterprise would have to be probability. One could never prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that the resurrection happened. Questions could always be asked which are unanswerable. But what I would do would be to use some of the basic criteria that are used in the general historical enterprise without the a priori points of view, and which are normally used in the court procedure where you have maybe a person's life at stake and you have different stories told, and as a judge or a member of a jury, you have to make your mind up as to which, if any, story is true. In other words, you have to make a decision as to what actually happened. Now, some of these criteria are the following: the criterion of consistency. You find inconsistencies in the story, you begin calling it into question. The adequacy of the causal nexus. Do the results, or can the results be adequately explained in terms of the causes attributed to them? For example, with regard to the resurrection, if, say, the resurrection was a grand hoax perpetrated by the disciples of Christ, does such a view account for the birth of the early church? For what the followers of Christ did with regard to their convictions concerning the resurrection? Do you make up a hoax and then give your life for it? Okay. The character of the witnesses. That's always an element in whether or not you believe the story, what kind of person is telling this story. Is this person credible, believable? The reactions of the enemies. And incidentally, one of the interesting things about biblical phenomena is that those who tried to reject the Christian faith very often accepted the events of the Christian faith as events, as happening. They try to attack them in other ways, but they accepted them as happenings. Whereas normally you would expect those people to question them. That's the substratum of history. So these are the kind of criteria that I would use. And as I say, there is no perfect use of these criteria, but I'm a little uneasy with the point of view that says that scriptures are beyond any kind of validation and you simply accept them by faith. Not that I question the fact that the Spirit does play a role by way of validating scriptures with regard to the individual believer, but I think the Spirit does work through historical reason. Otherwise, I think we would be hard put to it as to why we believe, say, the scriptures, the Holy Bible, is over against the Quran or some other collection of materials which are claimed to be authoritative by other groups. What grounds do you do that? Unless you have some objective basis for validating materials. Now, this is an area that we could spend all the rest of the time on as such. And I want to move beyond this primarily because you already believe in biblical authority. If you didn't, I'd have to do something of this sort. Otherwise, there would be no point in moving on to try to relate this to life unless there's truth here. But of course, we have to be apologists, although how this relates to the whole area of apologetics is another matter. And there are some people who would argue, again, that apologetics don't really have much value. The best apologetic is charismatic. In other words, to proclaim or to testify what's happened as to what's happened in your own experience. That's the best persuader. And in some cases, that's true. In some cases, you get nowhere arguing the validity of scriptures rationally. Even in terms of historical reasons. So sometimes the breakthrough is in terms of testimony or in terms of proclamation. But on the other hand, it seems to me that where possible, the approach I suggest here, this kind of historical validation, has its place and its values. So I suppose the significance of this then would be primarily with regard to how you and I deal with those who don't accept biblical authority. We ourselves accept it, so we can move on and relate scriptures to life, but other people don't. And what do you do with them? And I think this is a helpful device. As I say, I don't think it's the only device, but a helpful device by way of dealing with that issue. But I again note that there are those who strongly, very strongly disagree, and those who would laugh at you if you propose this. I know why they're laughing, but I don't agree with their laughing. Just that I don't laugh at them. I propose something else, although I might laugh too. Does this say enough to at least open the area up for you in terms of one of the things that needs to be done with those who don't accept the biblical authority?
You're saying that this, what we've been talking about the evaluation. This lecture that you have given is fundamental. It's the foundation that we must have in mind before we can really evaluate, apply the Bible to ourselves. We've got to believe it's true. Truth.
That's right. I mean, you can trace what we have done up to this point, and then having interpreted the text, say, now I don't believe it. There is a clear differentiation between interpreting the text or asking oneself, for example, what did Paul believe, which is what's involved in past historical interpretation of the text, you see, and then asking the question, do I believe the same thing? And the question, do I believe the same thing, really asks the question, is this true? Is this authoritative? And how can I validate this authority? So I simply indicate this as part of the process of evaluation, in general. We don't deal with evaluation in specifics, in specifics primarily, but this is a kind of evaluation that needs to be done, if and when there is not acceptance of biblical authority. Other comments or questions on this? All right, let's move then, operating on the basis that we do accept the biblical authority, faith and practice. The question then has to do with specific evaluation prior to application and then the application beyond that. I was interested in an article that appeared, in Christianity Today, October 24, 1980 issue, in which the reports of a Gallup poll were given. And the interesting statement was made by Paul Feinberg of Trinity Evangelical Divinity School to the effect that one of the findings of the poll was that the knowledge of the scriptures and daily meditation on them is clearly the most important force in building the kind of Christian character that can remain faithful to traditional Christian values, more important than any other formative influence identified in the survey. In other words, what he is saying is that what Bernard of Clairvaux indicated really works. The Bible is a book to be lived, and the Bible does affect life. And the finding was in that survey that it is the Bible that most affects life in terms of certain values. And the article goes on to indicate how that happens, even in areas such as social ethics and such areas where evangelicals traditionally have not been as interested as they should be. That was the case in the survey. So what J.A. Bengel said was right, namely, apply the whole self to the text. That, of course, is the interpretive process. And then apply the whole text to thyself. Use archaic language, but yourself. So that's the application. But that's much more easily said than done. As Edward Long points out, he says, there is considerable agreement that the Bible is authoritative for Christian ethics. But there is little agreement concerning how it is authoritative. That's the real issue. So the issue is not primarily the issue we initially raised. Especially among those who are concerned at all about the scriptures. Those who don't think they have much value if you don't look at them, for the most part. But it's the how that's the real issue. Now we'll be talking about various approaches that are used, and maybe I'll have a chance to use this transparency I have in my hands later on, but I'm not going to use it for the time being. There are various approaches used which I think have fallacies in them. We'll introduce them in other ways. I'll hold this out and introduce them when I come to them. First of all, let's indicate that one could use one of two approaches to arrive at a biblically based ethic. And I'm differentiating now between a biblical ethic, which is not what we're looking for in terms of actually moving from the text to life, because if that were the case, we'd find out whatever the conduct was in Scripture and then go out and do likewise. It would be like the Jehovah's Witness in my question when he told me that the Bible was his authority for life, and he went out to indicate that he rather regularly got drunk, and I asked him where he got that in the Bible, and he pointed to the Genesis passage concerning Noah getting drunk, and he says Noah got drunk, and so I go out and do likewise. And that's a biblical ethic. So we're talking about a biblically based ethic, which assumes some evaluation of the biblical ethic as to whether or not it is relevant, whether or not it ought to be duplicated and practiced in life. I remember our son Bob's having heard his grandmother read the story of David and Goliath, and then immediately he wanted to go out and find a sword to cut someone's head off. I mean, that's a biblical ethic. Usually common sense takes over and tells us, well, that's in the Bible, but don't you do it. For various reasons. But we have to differentiate between a biblical ethic and a biblically based ethic. Now, there are two possible approaches, and we'll use them both here in what we do. One may begin with a biblical text without any particular ethical issues in mind or ethical problems in mind. And then simply move to whatever problems are relevant or situations are relevant to the text as the text is expounded. Or one may begin with ethical situations or problems and then try to find what areas in scriptures are relevant to them and identify those areas and interpret them. You can move either from the Bible to ethical situations or from ethical situations to the Bible. And by the way, the latter is a good thing to use sometimes in teaching the Bible. If one could begin with describing an ethical problem and then say, with this problem in mind, let's now turn to this passage and see how this passage addresses this problem. Sometimes that enlivens the whole process, makes it much more relevant, makes it much more interesting, makes it much more meaningful. So this second approach can be used actually in Bible teaching, say nothing of this process that we're describing here. Now, in terms of what we're about to present, we'll assume we're dealing with the first one of these, although the basic principles we enunciate here and the basic stages are applicable in both cases. One would have to make some revision as to sequence, but otherwise they're applicable in both situations. There are three components to this process. We're now thinking in terms of specific evaluation. Namely, biblical analysis . This assumes, of course, sound interpretation, although one might need to do further interpretation as one deals with a particular issue, as we shall see as we move on right here. But what we're saying is that, as we've indicated, first you interpret, and then you apply, and you can evaluate before you apply. The latter can be done properly only if the former is done properly. You can't have sound evaluation and application unless you have first sound interpretation. So that's part of biblical analysis, but really reaches back into the interpretive phase. The one that's particularly relevant here would be valid evaluation. Asking the question as to whether the truth that has been interpreted soundly is now relevant to contemporary situations and to be practiced in contemporary situations. Now, sometimes this evaluation, besides requiring biblical analysis, will require this second aspect, namely the analysis of situations, contemporary situations. Sometimes that helps to determine whether a truth is relevant to the present. But there are biblical criteria as well. We'll focus primarily on those, but I'm simply indicating that here again, you cannot define the steps precisely so that you do this, the first one first and totally, and then you move on to the second, and the second has no bearing on the first. These two might interact on each other, particularly the second on the first. And then the third step, which is application proper, would be relating the biblical statement, if and when it's found to be relevant to the present situation, once you've analyzed that situation, to that situation. So you interrelate the biblical truth to the situation as analyzed, and that's application proper. Third step. Now, let's take each of these. I've surveyed the whole now, and we're ready now for the parts, but let's begin with biblical analysis. Now, let's begin by discussing the reasons for evaluation of biblical statements, and we're talking now about specific evaluation. And I would say these reasons involve two elements. One, the character of biblical documents, namely that these are historical documents addressed by specific individuals to specific individuals at a specific place and time in history. And therefore, though scriptures contain universal statements, they are, for all intents and purposes, historically and culturally conditioned. Now, very often we take the pronouns of the scriptures to mean us. Come unto me, all you that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. But if Jesus was addressing a particular group of people, the antecedent of the you would be that group of people. Okay. Now, that truth addressed to that group of people might be universally relevant. What I'm saying is that sometimes we mistake certain pronouns that actually are historically conditioned. The you had to do with the crowd addressed by Jesus when he made that statement, you see, and take them to be universal statements. Now, this historical conditioning happens in various ways. It's most evident in the Old Covenant, although it's also present in the New Covenant. You cannot explain many practices in the Old Covenant, circumcision, wars of extermination, many of the hygienic laws, etc., apart from historical conditioning. In fact, in many cases, you really have historical levels. Circumcision, for example, was practiced in other cultures besides the Hebrew culture. What happened was that that practice, which was found in other cultures, was reinterpreted in terms of the covenant for the Hebrews. Now, the second factor that theology has to do with the character of history. That is, if history is paradoxical or dialectical, in some respects, we'll take the second one first, in some respects, history is invariable. Now, I hesitate to say that history repeats itself because, in a strict sense, history never repeats itself any more than a river can ever be the same river at two consecutive moments. You know, you say it's the same river, but if you put your hand in the river at one moment and then you put your hand in the river at another moment, the river you're putting your hand into is different in the second moment from the first. And so there can never be the same confluence of elements in history at any given time as there were in a previous time. But you know what we mean when we say history repeats itself. There are certain recurring elements in history. Now, it's for that reason that past history has some relevance to present history. If past history were completely at variance with present history, then past history would be irrelevant. And our study of scriptures would be purely antiquarian. We'd be interested in knowing what the Jews believe and what kind of documents they wrote and what kind of culture they had, etc. But when you're through with that, and you're through satisfying your curiosity, that's the end of it. If there's complete disjuncture within history. So there are some things that are repeatable and are to be repeated. I'm noting two different things there. Are repeatable, can be repeated. There are many things that can't be repeated. Are repeatable and are to be repeated. Now, let me just finish the second one before I move to the first one. There's a difference between what is historic and what's historic. Now, what's historic is that which has significance for us, which means that in some way it can be repeated, it's repeatable, and it should be repeated. But there are other elements in history which are variable. And our situations are also historically conditioned. And we're historically conditioned. There's no way in which we can escape historical conditioning. Therefore, if the scriptures are historically conditioned and addressed to one set of conditions, and we're historically conditioned and live in a different set, a radically different set of conditions, then in those areas, the scriptures are not relevant to our condition. Now, we'll see how that's true with regard to certain aspects of the Old Covenant, and I don't know whether it's, I can't remember where I said certain things, but maybe it was in this group that I said, beware of those who give you only Old Testament references for their ethical principles. Beware. The success theologians, they're always quoting the Old Testament. I don't think I've heard one quote the New Testament. Beware of those who believe in certain ideas concerning Israel, what's going to happen with Israel. I always quote the Old Testament, where you have statements about the land in the New Testament. I don't find it, except where to look for a different kind of rest from rest that is missed in the land, in Hebrews 3 and 4. So when we talk about the authority of Scripture, we're not talking as if every single part of Scripture is authoritative or equally authoritative. But the Scriptures are self-critical. In other words, there is in Scriptures progressive revelation. That's found in the two covenants. That's why we call one old. Old means old, not merely ancient. Okay. But as the author of Hebrews puts it in Hebrews 8:13, it's obsolete and near to vanishing away. And by the way, progressive revelation has to do with the fact not that God himself, when he discloses himself in a certain way at a certain juncture in history, discloses himself in that way simply because he doesn't know a better way to disclose himself. It isn't a matter of God's progressing in his self-understanding or in his understanding of ways of disclosing himself. Rather, it's that God accommodates himself to the historical conditioning of those to whom he's revealing himself. Yep, that's his historical conditioning. So, if God is revealing himself to people who believe in a Ptolemaic worldview, or a geocentric worldview, namely that the sun revolves around the earth, he'll talk to them in Ptolemaic terms. If he didn't, he wouldn't reveal, he would hide, he would confuse. Okay? Now, when you get into in a different culture that sees the world in different terms, you have a Copernican worldview, you have something different again. Okay? And the other issue, which is implicit in all this, has to do with cultural orientation. And by the way, just let me say in closing, if I may, that the issue here that we have raised is not merely a temporal issue. It's not merely a matter of time. It's a matter of culture. Because, as a matter of fact, as some of you know, we have some people living in the 20th century who really belong to the Stone Age culture. There are certain tribes that are Stone Age tribes. Now, by the way, in some ways, perhaps those people ought to be approached in terms of certain Old Testament practices which would be relevant to them, but which are not relevant to us in a different culture, though we live at the same time. And incidentally, this is involved in cross-cultural communication, cross-cultural evangelism. What might be relevant for a person in the culture of the United States might not be relevant for a person in the culture of India, and vice versa. So you can't simply think of it in terms of time. That's really a cultural matter more than a temporal matter that's involved. Okay, we'll go on to talk about the purpose of evaluation and the process of evaluation, etc. And try to clarify this matter as much as we can, and then try to put it into practice as we move on. Thank you. We'll see you tomorrow then, and we'll continue this discussion.
There it is.
We began with general evaluation. We moved then to a specific evaluation, which is our primary concern here. That is the assessment of individual biblical statements as they're interpreted to determine whether they're relevant to contemporary situations. And you may recall we indicated briefly that there are two reasons for this kind of specific evaluation. One, the historical character of biblical documents that are addressed to particular situations, and the character of history itself. Some situations in history are essentially invariable, unchanging, and therefore what would be addressed to those situations would continue to be relevant. But certain situations in history are variable. And in those cases, what is addressed to them might not be relevant, at least in certain ways, to different situations in the present. This leads us then to differentiate between what is historical. Of course, in a certain sense, all scripture is historical, at least in terms of substratum. It has to do with events. God who acts, acts of God, and acts of human being in history, human beings. But not all are historic. Those are historic which deal with invariable, essentially invariable elements in history. And therefore have significance for us, which is what we mean by saying historic. It's over against historical in terms of having to do with event or occurrence. Any questions now on that? Yes, the historic is that which has significance for us and therefore is both repeatable and to be repeated. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Those are two distinct elements. So we'll come to that in just a moment in terms of what our purpose is in this evaluation.
If you had time later on, I would appreciate maybe working with a specific illustration of what is historic and what is historical.
We'll be doing that as we move along. All right, the purpose of evaluation, then, is to determine whether biblical statements are cultural. Now, those would be the ones that are addressed to variable situations, in which case, because they're addressed to a particular cultural situation in scriptural times, which then changes and is essentially different now, would be so culturally conditioned that it would not be relevant to the present. As over against those kinds of truths which are transcultural, which really address to at least invariable elements in culture, which as a result are also relevant to the cultural situation today. So, in a sense, this distinction we've indicated here as between what is conditioned and what is unconditioned is valid. It's not absolutely valid because everything, in a sense, is conditioned. There is no such thing as unhistorical statements in the scriptures. At the moment you say they're historical, you say they're historically conditioned. But in another sense, there are those which are so conditioned by history that given a different historical or cultural situation, they're no longer relevant. There are others that are not essentially conditioned by history, so that they continue to be relevant in the present. Now, the difference then between them is this. The cultural statements, which are not in and of themselves relevant, are those which are unrepeatable or not to be repeated. Now, the kind of thing that would be unrepeatable would have to do with, say, when you talk about Christ-likeness, if you think in terms of the crucifixion of Christ, that's virtually unrepeatable. If you and I, as a result of discipleship, were to become martyrs, in all likelihood, we would not be crucified. We would die in some other way.
In the same instant, historical happening have both a cultural and transcultural significance?
It may have. We'll come to that that distinction later on, that possible distinction later on. We're talking now about the statement in its own right, as it is, once interpreted. Or something could be repeated, but ought not to be repeated. For example, the injunction, go sell all you have and give it to the poor and follow me. That could be done. The question is whether it should be done. Now, by the way, this cultural element involves not only the general milieu in which the statement is made, but also the concrete individuals in the statement. It may be that in some cases one ought to take vows of poverty and for all intents and purposes go dispose of everything one has and give it to the poor and follow Christ. As you know, there are some who take such vows. Maybe some should. But the point is, you cannot simply take that teaching, for example, in Mark 10:21, and say, go out and do likewise. All individual. Because beyond what I've indicated to you, it may be that one of the best ways of helping the poor is not simply to go out and sell all you have and give alms. We know of other ways of helping the poor now. We have other ways of helping the poor, which may be more effective. For example, not simply giving out dole, but enabling the poor to develop means for helping themselves, which you may not do simply by handing over what you have to the poor. So those are cultural elements. Now back here, the main way to help the poor was almsgiving. Not the way to help the poor, but history has moved on, cultures have changed, so there are other means. So one could repeat that, but perhaps one ought not to repeat that, at least as a usual kind of practice. Now, transcultural statements, those statements cut across culture, the transcultural concept, are those which are both repeatable and to be repeated. Here again, both of those elements which are distinctive ought to be kept in mind, because some things are repeatable which ought not to be repeated. For example, we talked about what David did to Goliath. You and I could go out and buy a sword and cut the head off of an enemy of God. You might not find a giant somewhere, but we could cut off the head of the enemy of God, as the Crusaders did, by the way, early on. The question is whether something which could be repeated should be repeated. But of course, it must be capable of being repeated before we have to make a judgment as to whether you ought to repeat it. And if it's not repeatable, then of course it's not simply obvious the possibility of being repeated. So there are the two conditions with regard to each. Is it unrepeatable or repeatable? And is it not to be repeated if it is repeatable? Or is it repeated if it is repeatable? The first kind is not relevant or applicable as such. Now, we'll get into ways in which it might be applicable. But that goes beyond the statement at its face value, such as David's slaying Goliath. There may be some elements in that act of David, which are both repeatable and could be and should be repeated. Okay. But I'm not just talking about the statement or the event in that case of face value, whereas transcultural truths are those which are relevant to the cultural situation now, because the cultural situation has not significantly changed, or because the truth was addressed to the kind of situation that is essentially invariable. And therefore applicable to the present. Okay, now we'll be giving more examples of these as we go along. If they're not clear enough for you to be able to follow us as we proceed, well, let me know that we're not out of there. Now, what is the methodology for evaluation? How do you go about evaluating passages? I've indicated three things here. Beginning with, the major area where this evaluation needs to take place is with regard to the Old Testament. essentially, the reason why you have two testaments of good covenants is because of this whole matter of historical cultural change. I think maybe I mentioned Wars of Extermination. And by the way, Mosley's book on the ruling idea of the early ages has an excellent treatment of Wars of Extermination, which, by the way, are repeatable, but not to be repeated if you evaluate in the light of the New Covenant. Wars of Extermination took place because God was dealing with a culture that thought in terms of exterminating those who are the enemies of God. That was one of the ruling ideas, as Mosley puts it, of the early ages. And so God, in the process of accommodating himself to the cultural situation by way of revealing himself, commands that kind of practice in that situation. But now situations have changed. We've grown beyond that. And by the way, there is a concept of the progress of history. So that there is an evolutionary concept of history involved in some sense, not in the sense in which liberal theologians obviously have pushed that, because in some ways we're not essentially any better than primitive or primal people. But there are other ways in which we have moved beyond this kind of thing, and so no longer think in terms of the inevitability of exterminating the enemies of God.
That seems to ignore the face value of the statements in the text that gives reasons for the annihilation of people, such as that their time of wickedness had been fulfilled and that God wanted them exterminated so that they would not
Well, let's take the latter one. A number of reasons, by the way. In fact, they were thought of as sacrifices to God, as offerings to God. You said the whole picture. So let's take the latter one. There's a lot of people around that cause us to stumble. We don't kill them, though, do we? We don't get, you know, a lot of people who can induce us to idolatry of one form or another, but we don't kill them.
What is the evidence, then? God's accommodating himself to people's worldview. It seems that God is trying to give them a different worldview than the people around them, not accommodating himself to the worldview they already hold.
Well, in that case, the one is a means to another. In other words, the way in which to give them a new worldview is to deal with them in terms of certain practices and customs which they already have, and apart from which they cannot move to a new worldview. In other words, let me give you an example, a pedagogical example. When I took plane geometry, my teacher told me that the definition of parallel lines was two lines that cannot meet, but never meet, even if you extend them into infinity. Now, when I got into solid geometry, my teacher told me, now, just set aside that definition. Because, as a matter of fact, parallel lines can meet, because parallel lines are lines which are perpendicular to the axis of the Earth, which changes. Now, the point is that in order to get me to solid geometry, which is an advanced form of geometry, my teacher had to give me a definition which my teacher knew was imperfect, as a means of getting beyond that to the perfect. Now, take this in relation to Israel. One of the problems with regard to Israel has to do with the whole matter of a nation, of God revealing himself to a nation, a particular people, and somehow developing as pure as possible a view of Yahweh religion in that nation. That was bound up with land. That land was occupied by other people who had, of course, very different practices. And the question was whether it was possible to convey as pure a form of Yahweh religion as God wanted to do, and as was necessary to move toward a higher covenant, a new covenant, without getting rid of these people, both because they occupied the land, and you couldn't get the land without getting rid of them, although that could be done without exterminating all of them. but also because they would tend to influence the Israelites toward an idolatrous kind of religion, and therefore a violation of Yahweh religion. So there were certain historical cultural needs there that do not exist today, and should not exist today, at least in terms of those who have the new covenant. Now, as I say, this is not simply a temporal matter, it is a cultural matter, but those of us who have the new covenant don't need to think in terms of political entity. In fact, ought not to think in those terms, and should not think in terms of land. So, in fact, another example of this kind of thing, which doesn't involve wars of extermination, but involves essentially the same principle, are the imprecatory psalms. For example, Psalm 58, where you have the psalmist cursing the enemies of God. That was the whole idea, that the enemies of God were to be cursed, and in fact, the people of God were the instruments of that curse. They would carry out the curse of God, the judgment of God, by wiping these people out. When you come to the New Testament, taking now this matter of evaluating these concepts in light of specific New Testament statements and overall New Testament teachings, you come to the New Testament, and you have, for example, in the Sermon on the Mount, that we ought not to curse our enemies, but to bless them and pray for them and love them. Now, we'll be getting into this further in just a few moments, so I won't take that anything beyond what we've said. But you see how the New Testament goes beyond the Old Covenant. And as I think I said to you, beware of those who quote only Old Testament passages in terms of supporting certain practices or certain concepts which are to be practiced by Christians. In fact, I heard a noted evangelist, whose name I will not mention, preach a sermon in which he guaranteed that if the United States becomes a Christian nation, whatever that means, I don't know what that means, but whatever it means, if the United States becomes a Christian nation, he would guarantee that we would win any war we fought. Now, as you know, there are some who would ask whether Christians ought to fight wars at all. That question wasn't even raised. But he would guarantee that we would win any war we fought, and what did he do? He recited passages, which I could point out, Deuteronomy 30, elsewhere, that indicate that God guaranteed Israel, that if Israel obeyed God, then God would guarantee victory in battle. Okay. But he didn't cite one New Testament passage to support that. And indeed, if we look at history, and I ask who has won wars and who has lost wars, I think we'd have a real problem trying to justify that principle. That is, the more obedient to God you are, the more you will win wars, and the more disobedient you are, the more you will lose wars. There are some disobedient nations around this world who are winning an awful lot of, wars these days, and some more obedient nations who are losing them. So one has to be very careful with regard to these things. Well, I want to come back to this in just a moment. Let me indicate two more things. I indicated that it's in the Old Testament primarily where this evaluation needs to take place, but it also needs to take place in the New Testament, because there are some New Testament statements which are culturally conditioned and which relate to certain historical cultural situations which are substantially different now, which makes those statements as such, and I emphasize as such, no longer relevant, and therefore applicable. At least not necessarily so. I cited one with regard to Mark 10:21, the statement of Jesus, the rich man. You could take the statement of Paul in 1 Corinthians 11 with regard to women wearing veils during worship. By the way, the Roman Catholic Church, as you know, practiced that for many, many years, moving toward giving that up. The question one has to ask is whether that kind of injunction did not relate to a certain cultural situation which viewed veils as having a certain meaning. In other words, a respectable woman would cover her head. If you don't cover your head, you're unrespectable, perhaps even a woman of the street. Of course, if one came to be a Christian and practiced something which made that person disreputable, then that would bring disrepute on the gospel itself. Okay, in that situation, why then you wear veils. But if you come to it, and by the way, there may be some cultural situation where that's true now. See? That's why I say it's not merely a temporal matter, it's a cultural matter. But in other cultural situations, such as ours, that is not true. So we as Protestants, for example, we do not enjoin people to, or women, to wear veils when they enter places of worship, and rightly so. And then the third element has to do with what I mentioned yesterday, and that is that sometimes situational analysis helps you by way of getting at what's involved, what is cultural and what is transcultural. And at least part of that, we'll find this a little more in just a moment, part of that has to do with comparing and contrasting historical situations to determine whether they are essentially similar or different. I'm talking now about biblical and contemporary situations. Is the biblical situation essentially the same as the present situation, or essentially different? Essentially the same, then there's more likelihood that the statement made to the biblical situation is also relevant now, transcultural. If they're essentially different, the chances are the biblical statement is cultural. And indeed, with regard to this last one, and this one will not come back to, the other two will come back to as we proceed. With regard to this last one, I think there are three issues, evaluation based on historical cultural situations. One is, what is the historical cultural situation in which the biblical statement is addressed? Now, by the way, that is really, in a sense, an interpretive problem, an interpretive question. And it may be that one has addressed that question already in interpretation, has determined the answer to the question already, in which case, of course, one simply uses the answer to this question. If one has not dealt with this in interpretation, then one has to deal with this, in some cases at least, in evaluation. That's why I say, there is interaction between interpretation and evaluation at times. Sometimes in evaluation, you have to do more interpreting. You'll find out how that's true with regard to another aspect that we'll emphasize here in the process. Then a second issue is, how much did the historical cultural situation influence or condition the statement, the biblical statement made? Now, this is the issue with regard to statements about women in the New Testament, for example. Not only what was the historical cultural situation with regard to how women were viewed, say in Paul's day, but how much did that situation affect Paul's statement about what women ought to do or not to do, say in church? And incidentally, that might differ from church to church in the New Testament, or even with regard to particular issues within churches in the New Testament. We'll see that as we deal with some of the matters that will be coming up later in the course. And then the third question, would an essentially different historical cultural situation affect the current value or relevance of the biblical statement? Now, those are the three kinds of issues that ought to be looked at. Is that making sense to you?
Yeah. In both Old and Testament, there are certain moral standards that are common to both, and they're common to the culture as well as the Testament. Some areas of, say, South America today, there are certain moral standards that have become accepted, which are totally contrary to the New Testament. My question is, should the cultural situation always cause us to evaluate the text in certain ways, or should the text have its influence on the present cultural situation?
We're not simply talking about the present cultural situation alone as the norm for evaluating this. We're saying the present cultural situation has to be compared with the biblical cultural situation, and those in relation to each other need to be taken into account by way of determining whether a particular statement is cultural or transcultural. So you don't simply say because of a certain cultural situation, say in South America, and because this statement is different from that cultural situation, this statement then is cultural, not transcultural. You have to relate it to the biblical cultural situation too. So, for example, there are certain statements made with regard to idolatry in scriptures. Now, you might have in South America forms of idolatry, in fact, in North America as well, which may be in some ways different from the forms of idolatry that they had back there. In fact, they are different. We don't really have precisely the same idols now that they had at different times. But if the basic issue in both situations is idolatry, and those statements are addressed to that basic issue, then those statements, at least in some way, could very well be transcultural and determine the need to change the present cultural situation. All of this implies that the present cultural situation needs changing in some, indeed, in many respects. So obviously, if you made the present cultural situation the norm, then it would never be changed. So the assumption is that that life needs to be changed by the scriptures. So you need to take both the biblical and the contemporary situation into account as you do this kind of evaluation.
Issue in Africa, because we're running into our polygamy is pretty much accepted, and then the missionaries are going to say that now it's not true. How would you relate that to what we're talking
about? Well, by the way, biblically speaking, you started out with polygamy, didn't you? So that's nothing new. And what happened was there was a move toward monogamy. So in that area, there's no essential change historically. Polygamy is a transcultural situation, I would think that what was addressed to the situation initially in Old Testament times with regard to the need to move from polygamy to monogamy applies to any situation in which you find polygamy now. Now, what in cross-cultural communication, when it comes to relating the gospel to life, one has to differentiate between those areas which are essential and those areas which are not essential. Now, here again, one has to try to use the scripture by way of differentiating between those. The problem that missionaries have run into, Western missionaries have run into, is a tendency to equate the biblical ethic or the biblical lifestyle with a Western lifestyle. So to form life biblically is to Westernize it. See, and that's involved getting into certain things which are not like polygamy, which is not a Western matter. That's a transcultural biblical matter. But there may be some practices which are not in contradiction with Scripture, which ought to be allowed to be continued for various reasons. One of which is that there's no point in putting stumbling blocks before people that are necessary. There are plenty of stumbling blocks that are necessary. There's no point in putting unnecessary stumbling blocks, or even worse, there is no sense in distorting the gospel in the direction of saying that the gospel is some kind of Western lifestyle. Of course it isn't. It's an Eastern lifestyle, if it's any kind of lifestyle. You know. So that kind of differentiation needs to be made, but I would say polygamy is in the area of essentials, not peripheral or non-essential.
Are you equating transcultural purity? I mean, is the idea?
Well, let me mention two of the concepts that I indicated yesterday were perhaps incorrect concepts, at least I see them. One is the general principles concept, which, by the way, has been the basis for the liberal ethic, which is supposed to be biblically grounded. In other words, somehow you extrapolate from the scripture some general principles, like the general principle of the golden rule: treat others and as you would like to be treated. Now, one of the problems in that is that perhaps you'd like to be treated in the wrong way. Okay? And when you extrapolate that general principle from the scriptures, apart from a whole biblical context, particularly the New Testament context, which we'll look at later on when we try to ask ourselves, what are the overall, particularly New Testament motifs that ought to govern our effort? When you extrapolate that teaching from the fabric of the total New Testament ethic, you can run wild with it. Okay? So I would back off of the general principled idea. Now, there are some general norms. That's different. There are some general norms. Although even that could be misused. See, that's liberation theology, for example, which is current in Latin America, by the way. I think it's the last issue of Christianity Today dealt with, either the last one or the one before the last, in a meaningful way. It has to do with, again, a general principle that the people ought to be free. And certainly the scriptures have that as a general principle. God wants people liberated. But what happens is that is divorced from the fabric of the biblical ethic. And once you do that, then you've seen what happened. What happens with liberation theologians, they end up being Marxists very often. Because Marxism, of course, encourages revolution, which you know in South America, Dave. To believe in the principle or even norm of liberation, you end up being a Marxist, which, as I see it, is to end up being an anti-Christian. We find it in Marxism. Now, the whole question as to whether revolution is justified in some cases, we'll set aside for the moment. I'm not talking simply about revolution, qua revolution. And for those of us who are citizens of this country, must never forget that this country was founded by revolution. We often tend to look askance at other people who want revolutions or encourage revolutions and forget that we were founded by revolution. Let's set that aside for the moment. I'm talking about a Marxist revolution, not merely a revolution, but a Marxist revolution. See, that's the kind of thing you get into when you get into general principles which are extrapolated from scriptures. So I would hesitate to talk about general principles. The other approach, which we're really trying to address here, at least in some ways, has to do with the prescriptive approach. In other words, using the Bible as a rule book. You leaf through the rule book, and it doesn't make any difference where you find the rule. The Bible is a set of rules. That's the view. And it doesn't make any difference where you find the rule. You simply find the appropriate rule for a given situation, and then you apply it. That's the prescriptive kind of approach. Now, there are some people who wouldn't go that far. They wouldn't carry that to the absolute. But essentially, they still look at the Bible as having ethical value because it is a book of rules, ethical rules. Now, what happens, as I think I indicated yesterday, is that common sense causes us to sift out certain things. So we don't take certain things as rules because we know good. Well, and good, we ought not to go out and do likewise. You know, read something and then go out and do likewise. But there's a tendency to make of the scriptures rules. Now, what that involves really is this failure to see progressive revelation that we mentioned yesterday, and we'll try to elaborate that more today. Progressive revelation, in fact, if you have a movement from the old to the new transcends the old. But even within the new, the fact that the New Testament, even the New Testament ethic, is not a prescriptive ethic. I would submit to you that what's happened, say, in the area of divorce, is that the church, and this has happened down through the centuries, it's not something novel or not something practiced by a few individuals, but the church and certain bodies of the church have tried to reduce divorce to a series of rules, laws. Now, whether or not divorce is possible, and if it is possible, under what conditions it is possible. Of course, the Roman Catholic view says that divorce is not possible under any conditions. That's an absolute kind of rule. Well, of course, they have their their casuistic way of evading that by annulment. If you're married to a non-Catholic or married by a non-Catholic clergy person, then of course the marriage is null and void anyway. You could have cohabited for 20 or 25 years and have a family of 15 children, and you're not married. That's, by the way, that's what happens when you try to reduce the biblical ethic to rules. You end up with casuistry, with hypocrisy, with ways of evading the rules while still claiming to obey them. That was a Pharisee problem. That happens invariably. So one has to avoid a prescriptive concept for several reasons, one of which we're indicating, namely that you have to evaluate these things before you apply them. But there are other factors as well that we'll come across. Of course, the reason for the evaluation is also involved, namely that these materials are in some ways culturally conditioned. That's why you cannot reduce them to rules. Otherwise, if you allow divorce, you have to have it on the basis of the prescriptions, say, of the Old Covenant as to how you get a divorce. Well, we don't follow that prescription. We have civil courts. Divorce is now a civil contract as well as a spiritual contract. So we have very civil means of doing it. So you don't ask yourself, if divorce is possible, how shall I get a divorce? By following the prescription you find in the Bible. Otherwise you get into trouble. Very serious trouble, you see.
So, are you saying don't make a principle a rule, and if you have a principle, you have to evaluate the context that it was originally in and the context that you want to apply it?
Yeah. I would say, and with regard to the latter, I would say more interpret it in the light of the context. Really, that's a matter of interpretation, not so much evaluation. Okay. In other words, you can't lift out the golden rule, so-called, from the Sermon on the Mount and isolate that as a principle, or freedom, statements about freedom. The statement of Galatians 5:1, for freedom Christ has set us free. Take that out of the context of Galatians and the context of the New Testament as a whole and make that a principle and develop a liberation theology out of it. You have to interpret these things in context. That's a hermeneutic problem. It's a genetical problem. But that's the danger. That's the danger of getting the general principles. Or even norms. Although I talked about norms as we move along. Now, let's move to the first of these three steps of evaluation, namely this whole matter of the Old Covenant, the Old Testament, and its relation to the New Testament. I've indicated this already, but I want to pin it down. My own view is this, that the Old Testament is promise particularly with regard to the coming Messiah. That's the basic promise of the Old Testament. Now, there are other promises that revolve around that. That's the basic promise of the Old Testament. So, in a sense, the Old Testament prepares you for the New Testament, which fulfills the Old Testament in that, in the New Testament, of course, you have the story of the coming of the Messiah. You have the Old Testament preparation for the Messiah, and the story of the coming of the Messiah, and the creation of the church by the Messiah, by Christ, by the Spirit of Christ. That's essentially what you have in the New Testament. And this means, as, by the way, the book of Hebrews primarily points out, although Paul points it out in Galatians 3 and 4, and Ephesians 2, and Colossians 2, etc. The New Testament is better, as the author of Hebrews puts it, superior, transcends the Old Testament. Now, that involves two elements. It involves primarily the element of continuity, otherwise you would not have fulfillment. If there were total discontinuity between the two testaments, which is what Marcion taught, the Gnostic taught, and which is what Bultmann teaches in effect. Forget about the Old Testament as far as being part of New Testament of authoritative scriptures. The authoritative scripture is only the New Testament. If that were true, then the New Testament could not fulfill the Old Testament. So you have to have continuity to have fulfillment. So the basic element is continuity. And in the continuity, there is confirmation. What helps me is the testamentary concept of covenant. Covenant as a will, which, by the way, is used by the author of Hebrews, although Paul hints at the same thing in Galatians 3, where he uses a good example of a will, which is not annulled once it's ratified. In a new will, and Jane and I made a new will fairly recently, what we did was to fulfill the purpose of the old will that we had, although the old will is no longer the will under which we're operating these days. We fulfilled the purpose of it, and in addition, we confirmed certain things in that old will because they were still necessary to fulfill the purpose of a will, including that old will. But in order to fulfill, by transcendence, there must be also some discontinuity. In other words, there must be some abrogation. Now, I think every Christian believes that. The problem comes with regard to asking the question, what in the old will is abrogated? Now, there are those who will say that only the ceremonial part of the old covenant is abrogated. The moral part or moral law is not abrogated. Now, I have some serious difficulties with that. One is that is a dichotomy that is not found in the Old Testament itself. The Old Covenant is holistic. Old Testament believers do not believe in two kinds of law, moral law and ceremonial law. The whole law was moral. Some moral laws did involve rituals and others did not involve rituals. But all of it is moral. A person couldn't say, well now, I will obey the moral law that might be designated as being in the Decalogue, although that involves Sabbath law, which involves ritual. We see the problem you get into immediately when you try to make that kind of distinction. But I will not keep ceremonial law. As an Old Testament person. Well, what would happen is that you'd have the same punishments for violating so-called ceremonial law that you would have in violating so-called moral law. For example, you had capital punishment for violating the law, the Sabbath law, or which, as I say, is ceremonial. Let's take one that is clearly not ceremonial, the matter of honoring your father and your mother. Capital punishment if you didn't honor your father and your mother. But, as you know, the sons of Aaron were slain, part of Leviticus 10, because they brought strange fire before the Lord. Now, in both cases, it was a matter of obedience or disobedience. That's the moral issue, see? So, that moral ceremonial distinction is not really a biblical distinction. It's been introduced by theologians and ethicists by way of trying to make differentiations which are not really there. And by the way, anybody who says, people who say, and persons who say, that they obey the Ten Commandments simply don't know what they're talking about. Not one of us obeys, maybe I mentioned this before, the Sabbath law. You know, you have to take not only the statement in the Decalogue, which, by the way, has to do with the seventh day, on which many of us work, but you have to take all the regulations about the Sabbath. And none of us obey all.